Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Miriam Knight, who is the author of What Wags the World, Tales of Conscious Awakening. Miriam has gathered stories from authors, spiritual leaders, and other people that she, I guess, became familiar with about their personal stories of conscious awakening, which often predate what their shift from an ordinary life into one of becoming a leader in spiritual development, spiritual thought, and the global evolution that we feel needs to occur at this time in order to set things straight and perhaps change the direction the world is going. Thanks, Miriam, for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
So, tell us a little bit about your story and how you were guided to write this book.
Well, I am the publisher of New Consciousness Review, and I have reviewed, most of these people have written books, so I've reviewed
right.
their books, and then interviewed them on my radio show. So I became familiar with the stories, and I started to see this kind of theme emerging of people who have had profound experiences sometime in their life. In some cases, it was in childhood, more often in adulthood, and that this radically shifted their perception of the nature of reality. And so it put them on a very different path in their lives. So they might have, you know, done a 90-degree turn from where they were. And the thing about these people is that they're all really solid types. I mean, they're doctors, engineers, physicists, military officers, high-ranking military officers, real estate people. You know, it's just every walk of life. And they have their feet firmly on the ground, but then they had these experiences and had the courage to come out and write about it because they feel so profoundly that we have to shift our nature of reality, our perception of reality, and see that we are all connected.
Yes, I've interviewed a lot of these authors on Temple of Health as well, which I think this year I've been doing for 18 years. So one thing that has been curious to me is the timing of a lot of these awakenings. The early 90s seemed to be a very popular time for the awakenings to occur. I'm sure there's other time frames also in some of the younger people, but isn't it interesting that so many of these awakenings occurred at a particular, you know, five-year period?
I think, and this is getting a little esoteric, but I think it really did have something to do with the harmonic convergence.
I think it did, too.
Yeah.
So what do you think happened with that? Do you think some window of perception opened up? Or, I mean, how does that all work?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert in this field, but we forget that we are energy beings. And we are subject to the influences all around us, the electromagnetic influences. And certainly we know that the alignment of the planets, we're going through one, or we went through one very recently, where the sun, the moon, and various planets all aligned, and we had very high tides. We had a big, big peak in solar flare activity. And this all affects us because we are, we're made of water, and we react to all of the energy fields around us. We know that our health can be impaired by living near high tension wires. So, you know, it's not a stretch of the imagination to understand how we could be affected. The question is, in what way are we affected? And
in the case of the awakenings of consciousness, I'm hypothesizing that we are making a kind of a bridge into the kind of electromagnetic signals, or what some people call the Akashic field, or the universal mind, that we are, you know, kind of floating in energetically. And more people are being able to do this. This is a talent that indigenous people have cultivated for eons and have never really fully lost. And with our upbringing, we have suppressed it. We have ignored our own intuition in favor of evidence-based everything, science, what people tell us, the authority outside. And this is a time for tuning back in, listening to our own intuition, which is our connection to our own soul, in my view. It's our connection to our higher self, our connection to our divine self, all that is. And this, I believe, is what's happening now.
A lot of the authors in your book, being thought leaders, spiritual leaders, leaders globally, really, their awakening probably occurred at a particular time in order to get them ready for the work they were going to do. Do you see the rest of the world, or the part of the world that's capable of undergoing similar awakenings, occurring now and in the near future? Do you think there's going to be a mass awakening?
I think we're already seeing it. I think there are so many people reporting these things now that the people who actually come out and talk about it are probably the tip of the iceberg. I mean, for someone to write a book about an experience,
and you know how long that takes and how much effort, that for every person who writes a book, there are probably thousands, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people who don't. And one of my hopes for this book, What Wags the World, is that people who have had their own experiences and kind of brush them under the rug or tuck them away in some little corner of their mind because they didn't know what to do with them. They didn't have any place in their own reality to slot them into. It will give them permission to dust that off and to acknowledge that these things do happen. We are intuitive beings. Telepathic ability is real. Life continues. If you saw your grandma after she passed and, it kind of scared you, that is proof to you. That was a gift to you for grandma to show you that she's okay and that you don't have to fear death.
Yeah, that's a big aha moment, is that death is not to be feared. And, you know, not everybody's had a near-death experience, but probably most people have heard about near-death experiences. And it's almost universal that when one comes back from a near-death experience, they no longer fear death, except maybe if you have a very negative near-death experience, which is probably meant to get you on a better path in life so that you change your ways. But most people have positive near-death experiences. So I think and in your book, there's a number of descriptions of these and they're very similar in the energetic arena that they occur in, and also the idea that there is really no judgment with a capital J. You know, it's more of in a loving, unconditional, loving environment of life review rather than stern judgment of your life. So that's,
well, one of my favorite descriptions was David Bennett's. He was a deep sea diver who drowned and somehow found himself resuscitated. He later had the distinct impression that it was the Archangel Michael who hauled him out. But anyway, during his life review, as you say, he was surrounded by nothing but unconditional love. Mm-hmm. And yet, during his life review, he was able to view his life not only from his point of view, but from the point of view of everyone that he had interacted with. So everyone whom he had hurt or angered or cheated or mm-hmm. whatever, you know, he felt their pain.
Right.
He felt their unhappiness. And I think that that is hell.
Well, yeah, I think it's also very educational that we don't
absolutely.
Really realize how we feel more isolated in ordinary reality. We don't really have the capacity, unless we develop it through spiritual development, of empathy and really putting yourself in another person's body and feelings and thoughts. That is something that you can learn to do, and it's very helpful to do when there's a misunderstanding. I've done it several times and realized that the person totally misjudged something or didn't understand something, and then I was able to correct it. So it's a great way for conflict resolution, because usually there's a misunderstanding. But in these near-death experiences and the subsequent life reviews, which really help the person to understand, you know, the lessons that they came in to learn and what, you know, how they did. And then, like you say, how from other different perspectives, especially when we get off the path and do things we're not supposed to do or handle things in a different way that is the best, we can see the effect it has on others, truly has. Not, you know, with all the veils down.
And it did indeed change his life, because he came back determined never to be that person again.
Right. I think that's very true. I'm looking at Pim von Lommel's story right now. He's interesting because he's a cardiologist that then talks about the near-death experiences in his patients. I thought that was an interesting one.
Well, one of the things I liked about Pim von Lommel, he's a Dutch cardiologist, as you say, was that, you know, he is a science-based person. And mm-hmm. He started seeing a pattern among his patients who had had cardiac arrest. And he found that almost 25% of them reported some form of near-death experience. And he started recording them and eventually wrote a book. But it was this accumulation of reports from totally unrelated persons mm-hmm. that turned him into a believer in the phenomenon of A, the near-death experience, and B, the ability of consciousness to exist outside of the physical body, because not only were these people, you know, reporting the tunnel and the life review and being with loving relatives and so on, but they were also able to report on things that happened all around the hospital in other mm-hmm. places. So this is something that your friend Larry Dossey coined the term the non-local mind, that
right.
consciousness is not rooted only in our brains.
Right. It's almost like the brain is a receiver of a higher level information system that we can call the mind. The thing I find very interesting is in his bio, he was evidently a very brave man, or is a very brave man, because he published the first article in The Lancet in 2001 on near-death experiences. And as you say here, it caused an international sensation, because that probably was something that was quite on the edge at that time, for The Lancet anyway.
Absolutely. And this is something that I think we're seeing a shift in the times. Mm-hmm. And I, although, as you pointed out, there was this like surge of awakening experiences that happened in the 90s, the books are actually coming out now more and more, because I think the climate of public opinion is much more receptive to it.
It is, and there's still, you know, in many circles, there's still a, I guess, a kind of a, how do you describe it, a undertone of, if you mention anything about clairvoyance, near-death experience, you know, all of the different topics that are discussed in your book, there's still a an undertone of insinuating that the person is not all there, is not all, you know, may have, I don't know, other problems and agendas and everything. This is in, like, the corporate world or in the world of the hospital or the world of, you know, traditional, you know, traditional corporations and institutions. But I really feel like more and more people, more and more doctors, attorneys, business people, engineers are really having so many of their own experiences that they can no longer honestly participate in this type of thinking within their institution. It's almost like there's going to be a tipping point at some point where it's just going to open up for everybody.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that tipping point is really close.
I do too.
There was a study, actually, I think, in the past year of corporate executives using their use of intuition. And a vast majority of corporate executives, of the successful ones, were the ones who admitted to using intuition, where they took a decision. They didn't know why they did it, but they went with their gut.
Right.
And that, you know, that is really honing in on where we need to go. We need to tune in to our own wisdom instead of abrogating our own responsibility and, you know, just being part of the herd.
Yeah, that's true. Now, there's an awfully lot of stories in here, too, that have the scenario of a life-threatening illness, many of them very, very serious life-threatening illnesses. And the energetic shift associated with awakening seems to cure the terminal illness. What do you make of that?
I think the most dramatic and actually the most well-documented medically was the story of Anita Morjani. And she went into hospital in a coma with stage 4 lymphoma, had a near-death experience. And during that kind of time out, if you will, what she understood was that we have incredible power over our physiology as well as our lives. And that the reason that we get sick in the first place is that, in her case, that we do not love ourselves enough. And she just had this certainty. She didn't particularly want to come back, but she had this certainty that if she did come back, that she could heal herself. And when she returned, she had had lymph nodes that were so suppurated that she would have needed plastic surgery to close the wounds. And yet, they closed on their own, and they closed in record time in days.
Right.
And even while she was in hospital, they did a CAT scan and could find no evidence of lymphatic cancer. And these miraculous cures tend to be associated with the deep belief on the part of the individual that they can be healed.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's almost like they bring an energy back with them, isn't it? It's like, you know, it's like an energy comes back that is, I mean, that you can prove is different than what they left with, because it has this tremendous healing ability. They bring knowledge back, too. I mean, many people come back with all sorts of knowledge. Danian Brinkley is an example of one that came back with all sorts of, you know, prophetic knowledge and other types of knowledge.
That's actually an interesting phenomenon, these downloads of knowledge.
Yeah, aren't they?
I'd love to get one.
But don't do it with a near-death experience now.
Preferably not.
That's not always really that pleasant. I've interviewed many, many authors of near-death experience books, and they're not always real pleasant experiences in terms of the actual almost having to die part.
Yeah. But I wanted to go back to one point that you made about people with long illnesses or you know, terrible illnesses. Or you know, trauma like accidents where they're confined to a hospital bed for months.
Right.
One of the common themes that emerges is the best way to develop your connection to the universal mind or God or whatever you want to call it is going into the silence. And so, you know, in a hospital room, you're kind of in enforced solitude. For days, weeks, months on end. But you can do it yourself without the trauma simply by meditating or walking in nature, somehow turning off from the cacophony of the world and allowing the messages, the connection to develop, to actually reach you. When you say coming back with information, I don't think it's so much coming back. I think it's just clearing the channel of connection so that information can stream in.
Your last story, Suzanne Geisman, talks about the continuum of consciousness. That's an interesting idea. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? Because that's really when they leave, they're at a certain level on the continuum of consciousness, but when they come back, they're on a totally, you know, higher level of continuum of consciousness with all that means when they come back.
Well, you know, intuition can be taught, can be learned.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just like anybody learning, let's say, a piano, anybody can bang on the keys. But it takes practice to actually play a symphony or a concerto. Suzanne Geisman is a fascinating case. She was a commander in the U.S. Navy. Mm-hmm. She was on the staff at the Pentagon. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, insignificant people.
Right.
And what happened with her was that her stepdaughter died, and she and her husband went to see a medium, and the medium told them things that she could not possibly have known about their daughter.
Right.
And this really captured her attention because, you know, being an evidence-based, left-brained, trained person, she decided she really wanted to find out more about this and started actually writing books about mediumship. And she was in a class one day, kind of observing, and the medium turned to her and said, "Why don't you give a reading to every person in the room?" And she proceeded to do that and blew everyone away. So, as she says in her writing, you can develop these skills.
Right.
It's a question of practice. It's a question of openness and you know, and sometimes mentorship or guidance.
Yeah, I have a great story about that. I had a friend who was probably my friend for, I don't know, 15 years. He was a very interesting person in that he was an infectious disease doctor, a researcher that helped come up with the protease inhibitors, as well as an F-15 pilot who flew missions in Iraq. Now, I don't think too many people have those two jobs together. He was in the Air Force Reserves. And for many years, he just listened to me and another friend talk about spirituality and not really understanding what it was. And then, as often happens with men, and I'm not sure why this is, but he had a sudden spiritual awakening. He was out in California and had a sudden spiritual awakening. So he calls me, because I talk about spirituality, obviously, and he says, can I just fly out and have you help me with this, because my whole perceptual reality has shifted, like, and I don't know what to do with this. I said, sure. So he came out over Memorial Day weekend, and we just meditated and I kind of helped him through it. Then he decided to come back to Atlanta for a spiritual, I guess really a mediumship course, one in spiritual development, intuitive development. And he came out, he was staying with me, and he went to his first class. And, of course, this guy's very left-brained. And he comes in, he says, I can't do this. He says, I just can't do it. I said, sure you can. It's easy. And I said, all you really have to do is quit using your left brain. You know, use the part of your brain that you draw and you create with, and just don't try to reason it out. Just do it. And I gave him some other pointers. And he went back in, and he came back and gave me a perfectly wonderful reading with things that he could have never known. So he mm-hmm. mastered it immediately, probably like she did. You know, once you get the right path and quit doing it like you're trying to study physics or mathematics, you can definitely do it. And so that's an awakening story of someone who didn't write a book. These are the people you were talking about earlier. But nonetheless, he's currently an infectious disease doctor at Stanford, and I'm sure he's making a big impact on academic medicine.
I have a friend who is not in the book because he doesn't want this to get out, but he was he's a research scientist. He was the head of one of the major research institutes in this country. And he's been communicating with discarnate spirits for many years.
Mm-hmm. So there may be a lot more people out there than are admitting to it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for obvious reasons, some of the institutions still are very reluctant to acknowledge that this is a good way to get information. But it's probably one of the best ways to get information. I wanted to talk about that. What about using these channels of information for the major problems that we have now, cleaning up the pollution, cleaning up radiation, stopping radiation from spreading, undoing the effects of GMO? See, I think that this is where this information is not necessarily going to come through scientific research, who even fails to acknowledge that these are problems.
I think that there are many people working on these areas. But, you know, even in scientific research, I remember reading Richard Feynman's book, and he would mm-hmm. Focus on a problem before he went to sleep, and in the morning he would have the answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the distinction between science and spirituality is becoming much more blurred. We keep on hearing the terms quantum physics and quantum entanglement and the Higgs boson, the God particle. Mm-hmm. All of these new developments in science are blurring the line between physical reality and intuition and the interaction of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, and we have physicists in the book like Peter Russell, at the end of the day, it seems to come down to the effect of consciousness as being the organizing principle around which matter accretes and comes into physical form.
We've been using some spiritual technologies here at Millennium Healthcare and Plastikos for, I'd say, over 10 years with great success, using applied kinesiology, and especially when determining what to treat the patient with that has massive infections, fungal, including yeast and mold, viral, parasite, bacterial, intracellular bacterial. We treat patients who are extremely ill here. And you have to not only know what to treat all of those things with, but you also have to know what order to treat them in. Because a lot, say the viral effect of HHV6, which is a herpes virus that affects the T cells, that has to be treated first because those T cells aren't functioning until that's treated. And maybe the parasites don't have to be treated right away because they're less threatening. So we have these very complex clinical pictures that regular medicine has no clue how to even approach. And we've been using applied kinesiology as well as intuitive methods because many of the patients don't live here in Georgia. They live all over the world. So I continue to take care of them later, you know, and for years later. And often I have to determine treatments based on clairvoyant input information, which antibiotics, which antifungals, which, you know, which to treat first. They'll get re-exposed to mold and they'll get sick again. And what to do then, you know, how to get them out of a second relapse. So I guess I'm practicing a medicine that I can see being able to be used in other things. It's actually very accurate. It's very it saves the patient from having to come back often from halfway around the world for muscle testing, or and we basically have used the same method to determine the cause of disease, like, say, arthritis. There's about 7 different causes of arthritis, and if you determine which 1 to 3 to 4 causes the patient has and treat them, the arthritis actually goes away. So that's something regular medicine can't wrap their head around, that every single thing has a particular cause. Sometimes it's more than one thing, so you can't just treat one thing. You have to actually determine the cause of whatever's going on and treat it. And some of it is emotional, as we point out in some of these stories, the lack of love for oneself, the, you know, wrong thinking, wrong use of emotional energy, definitely that can be a factor. But a lot of times it's just too much arachidonic acid in meat and eggs causing arthritis. And if you cut out the arachidonic acid, the arthritis goes away. So, you know, and sometimes it's wheat affecting the gut, bad wheat affecting the gut, allowing circulating immune complexes in that causes the arthritis. So do you see how...
Yeah, but there's a deeper dimension there, Susan. I'm sure you'd agree, which is, I mean, a lot of people eat wheat and a lot of people eat meat. So why does one person succumb to arthritis, or why does one person manifest it as celiac or whatever? So there, as you say, there is an emotional or component to this. My husband happens to be a hypnotherapist, and you know, he treats it through consciousness. Other people will treat it through light or through acupuncture. We're like the blind man and the elephant. You know, we all see our own patch of the elephant, whether it's a tail or a foot or a, you know, trunk, and we're gradually pulling back and seeing a broader and broader perspective of how all of these things are interrelated, and, you know, pulling together the nutritional components, the emotional, the spiritual components. Did you happen to interview Kelly Turner about her book Radical Remission?
Yes, I did.
So, you know, here you have 9 common factors that she found in remission from cancer, and of the 9, 7 were emotional. How
yes.
Interesting is that?
Yes, but I also have evidence that just sleeping on a geopathic stress line can cause cancer, and moving off the geopathic stress line can cause it to go into remission, nothing else. So you see, there are emotional components, and most new cancers, I've had a cancer clinic here since 1999, most new cancers have an emotional component. But if you look at patients who, say, have survived cancer for, say, 15 years, but still have some cancer in their body, okay, what's making it grow then is usually not the emotional component because they've mastered that. But if they get into a bad electromagnetic situation, the cancer will come back. I recently had a patient who was free of cancer. PET scans negative, no active tumors. Her husband put a bunch of servers and Wi-Fis in their house, and boom, she had 134 new tumors. So
wow.
you see, it is, in my experience, you have to determine the exact cause or causes, because one of them could be geopathic stress. And how easy is it to move your desk or move your bed over a foot, or, you know, one way a couple of feet, compared to not knowing this and then, you know, having to try to treat the cancer? And probably unsuccessfully, because you're still on the geopathic stress line. So actually, this, what I'm discovering through this applied kinesiology, like the causes of cancer, let me just go through some of them. All the infections, bacterial, fungal, viral, parasite, all of them lower the energy of the organ. Electromagnetic, geopathic stress, generational curse, that's another one that even goes beyond this dimension as a cause. Hormonal in some instances, the toxic chemical, you know, a big problem, especially for people who are exposed to carcinogens. So what I found is there's not just one cause of cancer in most cases. In most cases, the energy of the organ has come down because of a number of things. And it might be the emotional that really kicks it in, and
it tends to be a cascade
to occur.
Too. But
the toxic chemical is there because you can measure it in the tissue. You see, I mean, you know, there's objective evidence of benzene and other carcinogenic chemicals in the tissue if you look. It's just interesting. You have to know the cause to treat the disease. Or at least for me, I mean, as a physician, treating the cause is primary. Now, there's no question that the person can have a spiritual experience, can have a remarkable healing, can have a spontaneous remission. And I've witnessed this, where an energy starts at the crown and goes to the feet. By the time it gets to the feet, there's no more metastatic disease anywhere in the body. And that's an example of a fifth-dimensional energy kicking a fourth-dimensional intrusion back into the fourth dimension. So an energetic thing can cure cancer, but that doesn't mean that you know what caused the cancer so that you cannot go back and have it happen again.
But still, in the case of that woman, why did her husband not come down with it?
Because he was sleeping next to her, and the geopathic stress lines are about a foot wide. He wasn't in it. If he switched places with her, yes, that would be a problem. He may eventually come down with a cancer. So, and it's actually very frequent that we see these geopathic stress lines in cancer patients. It's not rare. It's very interesting.
The other thing I was thinking when you were talking about the viruses and the fungi and so on, do you remember the work of Royal Raymond Rife? Where he found in his research that certain viruses, bacteria, and fungi were all different stages in the lifestyle of the same organism.
Right. And he had frequency treatments of that organism that really worked.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, this is a different time period. You know, when was Royal Rife in practice? In the 40s?
Yeah.
We probably didn't have electromagnetic then, did we? I mean, rarely.
We didn't have it as you.
Yeah, we didn't have radiation then either. Radiation was one I didn't mention, but high uranium levels are often found in my breast cancer patients. We probably did not have radiation. We didn't have mammograms then. So we have more causes of cancer now. Maybe back in Royal Rife's time, this infection was the main thing.
Hmm.
And it was ubiquitous or very, very common. I do believe I started culturing fibrocystic disease when I was biopsying it. And guess what? The majority of the time it comes back staph. Now, nobody has ever thought to culture fibrocystic disease, but fibrocystic disease is tender, and it's tender because it's infected. And fibrocystic disease is known to be a precursor of breast cancer in some people. So you see, the bacteria lower the and it's hormonal too. Fibrocystic disease is estrogen dominant, so it that's
yeah. But implicated in fibrocystic disease is iodine deficiency.
They've done studies of breast tissue with cancer and found low iodine levels.
Mm-hmm.
And for breast health, you should apply topical iodine every day to some part of your body. You know, it'll prevent it for sure because you absorb it through the skin. It's impossible to overdose on topical iodine.
I proved that on myself.
I worry about allergic reactions to iodine because I've seen them, and they can be pretty messy. So, you know, you have to be careful when you're taking iodine for a prolonged period of time, at higher doses anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's all sorts of it. But anyway, we muscle test this. I muscle test for iodine deficiency and recommend topical iodine when it's appropriate. Not for everybody, but for most people. Most people test for topical iodine. At least my patients that are coming here with fibrocystic disease and breast problems. So they're probably not eating a lot of seafood or seaweed.
Mm-hmm.
So. Well, we're coming up to the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Sure. I'd like to direct people to my website of New Consciousness Review, which is both a digital magazine and a archive of interviews and reviews. And the website is ncreview.com for New Consciousness, ncreview.com. And, you know, if you've had an experience, use the contact form there. I'd love to hear about it. And the book, of course, is What Wags the World, Tales of Conscious Awakening, available on Amazon and at your local bookstore, probably through ordering.
Well, thanks a lot, Marian, for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I really enjoyed the book. I thought it was a great contribution and a great, great thought that you had to include all of these stories in one location.
Well, thank you, Susan. My hope is that people will use it to validate themselves and open up and let their own intuition blossom.
Thanks so much for joining us, Miriam. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. We've been interviewing Miriam Knight, her book, What Wags the World, Tales of Conscious Awakening. Next week, we will be interviewing Joel Apania, the book of Positive Light, Remembrance of the Heart, and then Cindy Bentley on the 31st, Know Your Soul Path. Thank you very much for joining us for Temple of Health Radio Show.